Welcome to episode 15 of The Advent of Evolutionary Christianity, Conversations at the Leading Edge of Faith. I'm Michael Dowd, and I'm your host for this series, which can be accessed at evolutionarychristianity.com. And please do join the conversation. Today, our featured guest is Richard Rohr. Richard is a Franciscan who founded the Center for Action and Contemplation. He's a contributing editor for Sojourners magazine, and also a contributor to Tikkun magazine. He's the author of Naked Now, Learning to See as the Mystics See, and Why Become a Catholic, and many other courses and programs on audio and video. Here we talk about radical grace and evolutionary spirituality, and you'll see why Richard is revered by people across the spectrum.
Hello, Richard Rohr, and thanks for joining this conversation on evolutionary Christianity.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
I'm glad you're with us, too, because I have been tracking you for about 20 years. This is the first real conversation that we've had, but you've been an older brother on the path for at least two decades. And what I found particularly valuable about your ministry over the years is the way that you consistently come from a place of grace, of generosity, of soul, of spirit, in such a way that you're one of the thought leaders that really appeals to a wide variety of Christians. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners here early on just a little bit of your story, your testimonial, how you came to your current embrace of both your faith and also an evolutionary understanding of reality.
Wow, where do I start? Well, thank you, first of all, for giving me the opportunity. I was raised a pre-Vatican II Catholic in the 1940s and 50s, went off to join the Franciscans as a young man, and I joined them at a very good time where we were moving through the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. The men who educated me had been sent off to Rome and Europe and came back and really gave us good philosophy and good theology. They taught us how to think and how to use the tradition, not just to spout cliches, but how to integrate scripture and tradition and experience.
Yes.
So I was just given this great big gift. And from there, it just started moving. With all that great education, my second year, as a priest, I was put in charge of the retreat program for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. And the very first retreat I ever gave to a bunch of 19-year-old jocks who didn't want to really be there, they experienced what the Pentecostals would call the baptism in the Spirit. Wow. While I was preaching. And I didn't consider myself charismatic, but it led me into what became the New Jerusalem community. I was called the founder and the father figure. But all I did was try to catch up with what clearly was happening. I wasn't creating it. Everybody thought I was. But what it taught me more than anything else early in the 70s was what the Franciscans had taught me on some level, but now it was experiential, was that such a thing as spiritual experience was truly possible. And it wasn't all in the head. So I think that really helped me put together head and heart. From there, things just moved. I moved out here to New Mexico in 86 to found the center. It's called the Center for Action and Contemplation. And I've been here now 24 years, where we're trying to help people put those two together, their active engagement in the world and the issues of our time with a deeper contemplative experience. So my life has unfolded in ways I never planned, but in some ways it sort of felt organic how it happened. And and I know I never expected this. I just tried to keep listening for the next step, and it was always there.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a wonderful life. But I've been here in New Mexico now for 24 years, almost 25.
And you're in a beautiful part of New Mexico, too.
Yes, I sure am.
Richard, I'm wondering, could you say a little bit more about the mission and ministry of the Center for Action and Contemplation?
Well, in my early years, when I was still in Cincinnati, because of a set of recordings I'd made on the Old Testament and New Testament, I started getting invited to give retreats all over the world, actually. And there, again and again, I saw the tremendous social needs of our time and our world. And yet, to be perfectly honest, I often was disappointed in some of the responses that I found what I would now call dualistic thinking, either-or thinking, all-or-nothing thinking. I found it to be as much on the left as it was on the right. It was just a different vocabulary, but it still always split the universe into the good guys and the bad guys, totally right or totally wrong. So you can see why this set me up for the issue you're addressing, this whole unnecessary split between religion and evolution. It just, it doesn't make any sense to me why it should even be a problem. But I was forced into both and thinking simply by reason of working with people who are trying to do the same thing. And that's what the center is about. So we call it this long, cumbersome title, the Center for Action and Contemplation. But I always say the most important word in the title is and. And in my last book, I wrote a whole poem called And, because that seems to me what wisdom always comes to, what the contemplative mind can always see, that it doesn't create unnecessary dualisms. It doesn't create unnecessary problems. And for me, that's been the great loss to Western Christianity, that that we don't know that, that we've almost got a PhD in creating either-or thinking, you know? Yeah, it makes you an expert in saying but, instead of and. And so that's become, really, I would say, the undertow to almost all of the things I try to teach, a kind of recognition of the contemplative mind. And when you bring that to the social issues, you just have much greater wisdom and much greater patience when you don't have immediate success.
Yeah, I have often said that liberals who trash conservatives and conservatives who trash liberals, neither one of them really get evolution, because evolution is a dance of a conserving element. That I mean, DNA, you know, is conservative. It holds on to that which worked in the past, that which was vital to the stability or the survivability or the whatever of the organism or the society. And that's an essential component of any society or any being, for that matter, any body. But there's also a need for that which transcends what has been before, that which pushes the boundaries of the possible, expands the circles of inclusion, and that progressive or liberal element is also essential to evolution, and both are necessary. And it's precisely been your ability to, and not just your ability to do it personally, but in your teaching, you're constantly bringing people back to both and thinking. Get out of the dualisms. It's not either or. It's most often a larger whole that can embrace both, and that both have some role in the body. And the combination of that and the fact that you have from the start, for at least for a long time, placed a lot of emphasis on what I call orality, the oral mode of communication of information. There's something powerful that we've lost in a modern society in many cases, where we pay attention to the words that are spoken, teachings that come across in, for example, audio cassettes or audio programs that we can listen to, and then we create our own images. And it's different than reading a book. It's different than watching a video. And I know you've done those as well, but I remember my first introduction to you, I think, or maybe it wasn't the first introduction, but it was certainly an early one, was a friend of mine, and he gave me a copy of your teaching on the Enneagram and the audio cassettes. And it was my first introduction to the Enneagram as a way of thinking about human differences.
Yeah.
And, of course, that model itself has been useful to so many people in helping us to move beyond thinking that other people are fundamentally flawed because they're not like us. I wonder if you could say just a little bit about some of your some of the audio programs that have been particularly well received in the world.
Well, certainly the anagram was a big one, even though I've never considered that my main subject, but it exemplified that your gift is your sin and your sin is your gift, and you can't have one without the other, and don't mm-hmm. take your gift too seriously because it carries a dark side. You know, there it was, both and thinking.
Yes.
But also for Christians trying to put together Old Testament and New Testament and recognizing that it really wasn't old at all, that Jesus was a Jew, and unless we'd honor his Judaism, we really don't understand Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So the same theme just kept recurring of what you said, both and thinking. I tried to do the same with Paul, to recognize, yeah, he falls into moralism, but he's also a mystic of the first magnitude.
Mm.
And you might get upset at some of his moralistic lines, but don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yes.
He has a lot to give us. His whole tour de force on law. You know, I mean, if Christianity didn't have that, we'd be totally legalistic, I think,
mm-hmm.
or totally moralistic.
Mm-hmm.
The book I just wrote is on the two halves of life. That's going to come out in March. I call it Falling Upward. And again, it's the same thing. We need the first half, but you can't stop there. You got to integrate that with what I call the tasks and the goals of the second half of life. And my big disappointment in so much of organized religion is, it seems to me, and that's all I can say, but I've been a priest 40 years now, and it seems to me we keep doing the task of the first half of life over and over and over again.
What is that?
Well, it's basically giving yourself an important identity, a sense of boundaries, some impulse
uh-huh.
control, some law, some structure, some importance, and that you've got to do that. We,
mm-hmm.
I guess a psychologist would say it's building your ego structure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you go into the second half of life and you're still just trying to prove that my ego's better than yours, or I'm bigger than you, or stronger than you, or smarter than you, or holier than you, you know, it just, it starts dying on the vine. So
how would you describe, I'm curious, how would you describe the, sort of in a nutshell, the second half of life?
Well, if the first half of life is creating your container,
mm-hmm.
then the second half of life is, what are the contents? What's this container meant to hold?
Mm-hmm.
So what breaks through is much more a tolerance for ambiguity, which we would call compassion or mercy or forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
In Christian language, huh? Or patience. I mean, all the things we idealize as Christian virtues really necessitate a certain forgiveness of reality for not being perfect, you understand?
Yes.
For not being what we need it to be or what we want it to be. You see that God is so comfortable with diversity and multiplicity and
mm-hmm.
and breaking the rules with an ever new kind of animal or new kind of tree or new kind of plant that follows a different set of rules. If you just observe reality, you see that God is very patient, very creative. So second half of life takes on those kind of virtues that would allow us to love our enemies, for example. So we can all be taught, as we are, in Christianity, to love our enemies. But you and I both know that many sincere people, well-intended people, would believe that Jesus taught them to do that, but they have no software or inner ability to know how to do that.
Yes.
So that's what you learn in the second half of life, which I summarize as contemplative thinking or non-dualistic thinking, which allows you to be merciful, graceful, compassionate. Yeah,
that's great. It matches my own experience. I'm 52 years old, and I've noticed over the course of the last decade, especially the last 8 years, just a softening. My yin side, my mm-hmm. feminine side, my softer side, my less mm-hmm. arrogant side, my less dogmatic and sure, and all that. It's flowered just in these last 8 to 10 years in ways that in ways that just was not the case in my 20s and 30s.
Oh, you can't do that. In your 20s and 30s, you've got to keep solidifying your identity, you know, why I'm important, why I'm successful, why I'm good, why I'm... And by my age, I'm 67. I mean, that's just not an interesting question. It's like, oh, go away, Richard, proving that you're better than somebody else, or you're saved more than somebody else, or, you know, you don't have time for it anymore.
Right.
It seems that it's never true anyway.
Right. And so this is a book that's going to be coming out soon called Falling Upward.
Falling Upward, The Spirituality of the Two Halves of Life. It should come out in March. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's great. That's great. You know, Richard, you mentioned, and I was really glad that you did, that when we observe reality, when we pay attention to what's real, we can have our understanding and experience of God enriched. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about how has an evolutionary understanding of reality, an evidential understanding of reality, you know, a science-based understanding of reality, made a difference in your own faith walk?
Wow. Michael, it's almost foundational that if what's happening is evolving, then, of course, you've never got it. It keeps you with a beginner's mind. It keeps you with a kind of humility, a kind of expectation, an open horizon. And I think the bane of religion has been this closing down way too early. With the assumption that I understand or I know. And I think this is the arrogance that so many people have come to resent in religious people, not just Christians, the other religions too.
Yes.
That if you don't have, well, the way I put it is knowing in the mystics was always balanced with unknowing. And that putting together of knowing with unknowing is, for me, the very notion of biblical faith. Now, when you eliminate all unknowing and make it all knowing, I'm certain about everything, and I understand everything, you're really, in my opinion, you're outside the realm of biblical faith. And you don't have people who are humble or in awe before reality. What an evolutionary perspective does is necessitate that you're always in kindergarten, you know, you're always in awe, you're always expecting more, you're always allowing God to be mystery, you never assume you totally understand. If religion had approached the world in that way, I think the whole world would love religious people. You know, but we're not loved today. It's just... we expect people to be split,
yeah,
which makes you into a hypocrite, because you have to be. Once you split, you have to be a hypocrite. And it's not even our fault. We're sort of doing what everybody else told us the religious project is. You know, I had to study Latin my time in the seminary, and I love to quote Augustine. He said in Latin, "Si comprehenderis, non est Deus." If you comprehend it, it's not God. You know, well, we've walked around for centuries acting as if God is in our pocket.
Yes.
Well, there's no notion of the deep meaning of incarnation, the deep meaning of time and unfolding and mystery.
Yes.
So I'm profoundly grateful for any evolutionary understanding. I think it returns us to the mystical level of all religion, and that's where all the power's at.
You sharing that, two things came to mind. One of them is the importance that I've found in Sally McFaig's work on metaphors and models of God, and that all of our language for God is necessarily interpretive. It's metaphorical, and that when we concretize, when we essentially make an idol of any particular languaging or image of the divine, we step out of the unknowing into the certainty or into the known or what we think we know, and we actually trivialize the divine to the degree that we do that. It's staying in that place of uncertainty, of unknowing, of not being sure, is actually a humility engendering process. And the other thing that it reminded me of is Jennifer Michael Hecht's book, Doubt, A History of Unbelief. She took a look at throughout all of human history, or at least it's recorded writing and stuff through the philosophers and theologians throughout the years, the importance of not knowing, the importance of questioning, the importance of not being overconfident and doubt and uncertainty, and that's also a spiritually necessary characteristic for us to continue on the edge of growing.
Well put, so well put. You know, remember a few years ago when the public press was shocked that Mother Teresa was suffering from so much doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And the very fact that they were so shocked by this tells me how far we've moved from the biblical tradition. You know, that she reflected the highest level of religion, in my opinion. And that's this living in partial darkness. You know? We localized the whole act of faith so much in the head that doubt became an intellectual dilemma, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas that's not where it's localized. It's much bigger than that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Richard, I wonder if you could also share a little bit more about how has a deep time understanding of grace. I mean, grace has been such a central concept to your own work, this notion of radical grace. In fact, if you could speak a little bit to what would radical grace and evolutionary spirituality, which is what we've titled this conversation, flesh that out a little bit. What does it mean? What does radical grace and evolutionary spirituality mean to you?
That's the name of our magazine, and it went back to a quote I used early on where I said, everything in the world is predictable. There's only one thing that's truly radical that gets to the root, and that's grace itself, which breaks all the rules. So for me, because I'm a Christian, I believe that the great trump card of Christianity is the mystery that we call incarnation, that we believe the spiritual world in Jesus became flesh, became human, became material and physical. And the hiding place, the revelation place of God is the material world. Now, if that's true, which is what I believe, then the incarnation, the human incarnation, began 2,000 years ago. But the mystery of the enfleshment of spirit began 14.5 billion years ago, approximately. That's the real birth of Christ. Now, you know, you say that to Christians, and they're shocked. But I point them to the prologue to John's Gospel, the hymn in the beginning of Colossians, the hymn in the beginning of Ephesians, the first chapter of the first letter of John. They all say without any equivocation that Christ existed from all eternity. And they say, oh, yeah, it did say that.
Mm-hmm.
But we never took it seriously. So to get to your notion of deep time, you're right on. Deep time is not just taking my moment as if it's the reference point, the be-all, the end-all, but how do I fit into past and future? How am I connected to this universal history, this geological history, this history of civilization? How do I situate myself inside of all of that? That seems to me to be the real appreciation for incarnation, and that incarnation is planted inside of the very nature of the world that God created, that God is revealing God's self in every creature. Every creature is a word of God.
Yes.
Now, my father Francis understood that in a very romantic way that the world has learned to love, when he called everything brother and sister. He gave subjectivity to everything. He gave a certain kind of equality. And no one had done that in precisely that way, or at least that beautiful a way. Then we had an early mystic in the order, St. Bonaventure. He was a philosopher. He took the experience of Francis and made an entire philosophical system out of it, in which he made that very point, that every step of creation, every piece of creation is another word of God, another footprint, fingerprint, revelation of the mystery. So you see what's happening, that the whole distinction between sacred and profane doesn't work anymore. It's not even useful. It's not helpful. It's not true. There's only one universe. It's all sacred, and it's all revealing the divine.
Yeah, amen, brother, amen.
I just think of how many of our people live in such a state of alienation, with low self-esteem, thinking they're unworthy because they've made it into a moral worthiness contest, when in fact it's merely a mystery you fall into.
Yeah.
And you're already a part of. You don't
right.
make yourself a part of it. You're already a part of it.
Right.
So the
yeah.
language is much more a language that we see in the mystics of surrendering, allowing, letting go more than any kind of achieving. It's the heart of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I so appreciate what you're saying. It resonates not only deeply with my own experience, that there was a dualism that collapsed when I realized that I was, in fact, as we all are, the universe, after some 13.7 billion years of unbroken evolution, now beginning to become conscious of itself, and that's
yeah.
the human
yeah.
is an expression of this mm-hmm. divinely creative process. And that to give God glory, to use religious language, that is to honor reality, to honor the whole, is that heartful response. Given that, how can we be a blessing to the larger body of life of which we're a part? And how can we contribute to it? And in some ways, it's kind of like an evidential mysticism or an empirical mysticism.
Mm.
I think Bruce Sanguin was the first one that offered that way of languaging it to me.
Mm.
He was the second one of our speakers in the series. But I remember back, oh gosh, probably 7.5, 8 years ago now, I was speaking to a group of Catholic nuns at a retreat center in Indiana. And there was a woman, I think she was 90, 92, she was very elderly, a nun, who came up to Connie, my wife, afterwards, and she said, you know, I've heard Thomas Berry before, I've heard Brian Swim before, but something happened in the course of this presentation here that I realized that the universe isn't just outside of me, that the universe is inside me too. And
mm.
and she was just lit up. And here was this, you know, 90-year-old nun
90,
that was like
yeah.
getting it in a different, you know, sort of a scientific mysticism, that she was having this mystical experience, that there was no separation between her and nature, that she was a part of this divine creative process. It was an amazing experience, because I talked to her afterwards, but Connie got that sort of raw, sort of just like, wow.
It's we made it so much into a moral matter. When you don't get to the mystical level, all you have left is, I'm going to say, low-level morality at that. You know, I'm not in any way as a Catholic trying to speak against the Reformation,
mm.
but I do listen to the arguments of Luther and Calvin, and they're still so preoccupied with sin and guilt
yes.
and shame, and as if the only issue is moral unworthiness. Because there's no mystical thing to delight in anymore. And it's we Catholics who had lost it. I'm not blaming them. But the fights of the Reformation are all at a rather low level. It's like, who cares about that? You've both missed the point, you know? So I'm trying to say both and. They both missed the point, maybe Luther and the Pope, in arguing about theories of salvation.
Well, and salvation was understood pretty much only in an otherworldly, unnatural, supernatural way back then. I mean, there was no sense that salvation also had a this world, reality-based way in this life. It was mostly about the afterlife, the other world.
And the individual human person. It wasn't the salvation of creation, or the new heavens and the new earth.
Yes, yes, yes.
There was
exactly.
no global notion to it or social notion to it
right.
at all. Even though we said in the Creed we believe in the communion of saints, it wasn't a communitarian vision by and large.
Right, exactly. And the communion of saints was usually interpreted in a, you know, in-group, out-group kind of way. Like, with we who practice the right practices or have the right
we're
beliefs,
in, yeah.
we're God's in-group, and everybody else is
yeah.
the out-group.
Yeah, yeah. It's a shame. But God must be very patient. I mean, certainly these many billions of years and then our few hundreds of years of Christianity, I guess God is used to this, that we argue it through. I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, Richard, one of the things that comes through in listening to you is this deep relational approach to life, recognizing that really relationships are at the heart of the cosmos. And I'm wondering how you think about that from an evolutionary perspective. And how do you imagine Christianity relating to other faiths and as individual Christians, us relating to this world from this sacred evolutionary understanding?
Wow, that's a good one. It's a big one. And let me go back to the very foundation. You know, some of my best-selling conferences in recent years have been two that I did with other people on the Trinity. And, you know, Karl Rahner said that we could drop the doctrine of the Trinity tomorrow, although most Christians wouldn't consider that, of course, and they shouldn't. But he said we could drop it and 98% of actual church belief and practice would remain virtually unchanged. Now, that tells me we haven't built on a solid foundation. If the very shape of God does not reveal the shape of reality, then our Christianity is still pretty immature. So you see where I'm going. Mm. If God is Trinity, then God himself, herself, itself is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my foundation, that God is not a noun, God's a verb.
Yes. Yeah.
God is an eternal circle dance, you know, from theology, the Greek word they use, perichoresis, you know. They took a word from Greek theater and applied it to the Trinity. If I did that today, they'd say I was New Age.
Yes.
But this is the Cappadocian Fathers in the 3rd and 4th century, that God is a circle dance. Once that becomes your template for the very shape of the divine and therefore the very shape of creation, then there's nothing that can be understood outside of relationship. So the later notion of the kind of gross individualism we have in the last three centuries, that just doesn't fit. It doesn't work. It's not true if our notion of God is true. So I'm sorry I had to go back all the way to the foundation.
But no, I'm glad you did.
Why relationship is so important to me. The I-thou relationship that Martin Buber speaks of,
mm-hmm.
for me, was revealed and mirrored in this very doctrine that we call God, that God is relationship. So now we had to create a new word. We call it ecology. The medieval Franciscans called it the great chain of being. We are now looking for a dynamic vocabulary to describe what's going on and to recognize what we've now seen in the atom, what we see in the galaxies, that it's all relational.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the old Newtonian world of simple cause and effect, just doesn't explain things well at
yeah.
all. It's many causes and many effects. Talk about mystery. It makes us much more humble. And the idea of the heroic individual saving himself or becoming morally superior or even morally inferior by himself, it just doesn't, it's not helpful anymore.
Yeah.
to think of anything outside of a web of relationships.
Yeah.
So thank you for seeing that in my work.
I've even come in recent years to thinking about spirituality. I mean, when you ask people what the word spirituality brings to mind for them, or how do they define it, it's often defined as a set of practices or meditation or prayer or contemplation, and mm-hmm. and all that's true. But I think those are in service, at least I've come to think of those as in service to something else, which is that I see spirituality, certainly evolutionary spirituality, as the practices and exercises that help us be in right relationship to reality, that help us live in right relationship to reality,
excellent.
That help us
excellent.
Support
yeah.
each other in living in right relationship
yeah.
to reality.
Perfect.
And, you know, the various sort of traditional exercises or practices that have helped do that are central to our traditions precisely because they're consistently effective in doing that. That when one quiets one's mind and attends to one's heart, when one notices one's thinking, when one stands in the face of what's real, what's undeniable from a place of humility and a generous interpretation, one is naturally led and empowered to be in right relationship to reality in ways that we aren't if we're simply relying on our own little monkey mind or our own narrow self-interest to move us forward.
Mm-hmm. You know, what a good spirituality does, Michael, is it resolves interiorly the old philosophical problem of the one and the many, that you find the truth within yourself at some level, on some experiential level of knowing, but then you recognize that it isn't just yours. It's a participation in something that's everywhere. Mm-hmm. We're speaking of theology today as a turn toward participation, not religion as believing things or observing things or judging things, but religion as participating in something. And once you move to that level, and true spirituality always leads you there, doesn't really matter what the practice is, if it leads you to an experience of participation with the mystery, then you know it's not just your mystery. You know that it's everywhere, and it's all the time, and yeah, it's not just mine. I didn't create it. I fell into it. And so once you see it at that level of depth and beauty, it's very easy to recognize that others are participating in that too.
Mm-hmm.
Not just those who use your vocabulary or your cultural definitions of things. So I hope we're getting there because, you know, we've got to. There's 6 billion of us on this planet. If we can't start honoring the divine presence in all people, all religions, and all things, I don't know what hope there is for the world. And I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but we don't have time for this in-house, my truth is the only truth, and my truth is better than your truth.
We've
created too many wars, hurt too many people by this kind of exclusionary thinking.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly where I personally have found, and a number of our thought leaders in this series have expressed as well, some, I would say, revelation, a revealing of divine truth in this epic of evolution, what's sometimes called big history or the great story, or as Thomas Berry sometimes referred to it as the new story, this 14 billion year story of physical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution as humanity's common creation story, and that we can all find that story allows us where our traditional religious stories typically don't facilitate that deep empathy, deep compassion with each other by just focusing on our scriptural stories or our traditional stories. And I that's where I find a lot of inspiration from this great story, this epic of evolution.
The dualistic thinkers, when we talk that way, they think we're talking either or. And so they get scared. They think we're rejecting our Christianity or backing away from our Christianity. Actually, we've gone into the depths of it. And at the depths, you find the unified field, as Einstein called it.
Mm.
So it's not, I'm probably more a Franciscan and more a Christian than I was 40 years ago. But what that means now has an easy ability to honor and include just about everybody else. And, you know, if that isn't the goal of history, how can we call Jesus, as we do in the fourth chapter of John's Gospel, the Savior of the world? Even the Vatican Mission Office has recently admitted that it's very unlikely that Hindus and Buddhists are going to become Roman Catholics. So they finally got the humility to recognize maybe our job is to love them as Jesus would have loved them instead of trying to make them like us.
Yeah. Well, you know, Richard, one of the things that I've really been thrilled about in this series of conversations is there seems to be some things that we really do share in common, certain values that we share in common, certain perspectives that we share in common. And one of the ones that seems to resonate with at least everybody I've talked to so far, and I want to just sort of bounce it off you to see if this resonates with you, is this notion that how reality is communicating isn't just through the tradition and through hierarchy. It isn't just through ancient sacred texts, but God is communicating to us collectively through the whole range of evidence, that scientific evidence, cross-cultural evidence, historical evidence can be legitimately seen as divine revelation, divine communication, that God is guiding us, to use religious language, through evidence. And and I've been really pleased at how that understanding has resonated rather widely with our thought leaders. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on you know, evidence as divine communication. The way I speak about it in my book is facts are God's native tongue.
The world of things is of itself the primary evidence. And Romans 1:20 says that. But I was trying to get at the same thing when I said that the principle of incarnation is that matter and spirit are one. We learn to honor it and recognize it and love it in the person of Jesus. But unfortunately, we made Jesus into an exclusive Son of God instead of the inclusive Son of God. And so we were right back into the sacred and the profane. The world was still split. When I love to use that symbol of the temple veil tearing at the death of Jesus between the temple and the outer world, seeing it as now one world. Now everything is evidence. I like that you use that word. It's all incarnation.
Yes.
So why should we divide this is incarnation and this isn't incarnation? No. It's things in their bare existence that finally convert us.
Yeah.
When we can surrender to them, when we can say, why does that exist at all? Why is there something rather than nothing? Why this tree? Why this animal? Why this scientific knowledge? It all becomes revelation. So if that's a theme you're discovering in this series, I'm very honored to be a part of it.
Well, thank you for the generous way that you shared that. Now, another one of the themes that I've noticed that seems to resonate with virtually everybody is, so far, everybody I've talked to also has agreed that we seem to all share what could be called a global heart, that is a commitment to the well-being, to a concern, a compassion that includes not just, you know, our traditional in-group, but that compassion, that care, that empathy, that commitment also extends to humanity as a whole, and indeed to the larger body of life. And I'm wondering if you have anything to share in terms of how you see evolutionary spirituality's global heart.
Well, you know, today is December 10th. It's the 42nd anniversary of Thomas Merton's death. He was one of my great teachers. He came to the monastery on December 10th of his 27th year. He died on December 10th, 27 years later. His life has so much symbolism to it. But one of the things he said is that if it is the sacred dance, this is an exact quote, but if it is the sacred dance, then it's always the general dance. Once you get it, if it's it, it's everywhere, or it isn't it. If you're not in the general dance, you're not in the sacred dance. That's what all of us are coming to realize, that if it's compassion, then it's universal compassion. It can't be just for my group or my political party or my baseball team or my religion. And that's the very thing Jesus is critiquing in his own Jewish brothers and sisters. And I say, why was Jesus inclusive in his lifetime? And then afterwards, we created an exclusive religion in his honor. It doesn't make a bit of sense. He's consistently including Samaritans, Gentiles, prostitutes, drunkards, and tax collectors. which is an utter critique on his own Jewish religion at that time. And yet we Catholics repeated the same thing all over again in his name. I think it's just where consciousness was. Everything was tribal, groupthink, ethnic belonging systems, using God to maintain our belonging system. But you and I are blessed to live in a time of not just general globalization, but spiritual globalization,
yes,
too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing else that makes sense. You know, and one final thing to that, if you'd think if there was any group that would have come to that, it would have been monotheistic religions who said there's one God who created all things. So we have Judaism, Islam, Christianity, all saying there's one God who created all things. And yet our history has been against unitive consciousness. You know,
yes,
it's been tribal, it's been sectarian, it's been ethnic, resisting the very move that one God would have seen to have moved us toward.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't resist it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We are all the children of one God, and if it's one God, then it's the same DNA and everything, the same divine DNA. So it's just easy for us to see that, and it wasn't easy for many earlier people to see that, for whatever reason.
Yeah. Well, Richard, in beginning to wind down, there's two questions that I just really would love to still invite you to respond to. And one has to do with what's often thought of as the fundamental feeling states that human beings have always needed to thrive, feeling states such as gratitude when we look to the past, mm-hmm, rather than guilt or resentment, trust when we look to the future rather than fear, and inspiration to be in action in the moment, whatever the challenges or chaos of the day. And throughout most of human history, the way that cultures, individuals, groups had consistent access to these feeling states were through various beliefs, mythic beliefs. And we now have evidence, we now have knowledge that can also get us there, but it does so not at the expense of the religious traditions, but it's actually helping the religious traditions themselves to evolve, which I think is a hugely,
yes,
important thing.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, when you think of the big sweep of big history, you know, the epic of evolution, our entire evolutionary heritage and our relatedness and our connectedness to that, I'm curious, where do you find in this science-based story, this common creation story, what are the things that you're most grateful for, and what are the things that nourish your trust most deeply?
You know, I probably was alluding to it earlier, what some call the principle of uncertainty, that scientists are willing to live with hypotheses, happily so.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have taught religion so much about faith, about mysticism, about what we called in philosophy epistemology. You know, we put all our emphasis on metaphysics, having the right metaphysical answer. But when I had to get my first degree in philosophy, not that I was ever that good at it, but the whole first year was called epistemology. How do you know what you think you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we were taught all kind of theories of knowledge. And, you know, I was amazed how even Thomas Aquinas, John Duns Scotus, said there's two kinds of knowledge. There's rational, but there's intuitive. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And how did we lose that now I see that it's science rediscovering it, you know?
Yes.
Like Einstein's intuition that whatever the universal field theory was going to be, he said he intuited it had to be simple, and it was going to be beautiful. Wow. I mean,
yeah,
that's all I'm saying. That's what religion was saying. And so I'm grateful for the humility about knowing that science has given religion. I don't think we've learned the lesson yet. In fact, we've pushed them into a corner because we don't want to learn the lesson. But I find many of my scientifically educated friends are much more dialogical, humble, and patient in conversation than we clergy are, for the most part.
Very interesting.
I think that for me is a,
yeah,
huge gift.
Yeah.
Because until we change how we know, and we keep throwing around what we know with such great certitude,
mm-hmm.
I don't think the conversation is going to move forward.
Yes.
So
yep.
it's that that would come to me first.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that from a sacred evolutionary understanding, when we think of science not as just a secular enterprise, but really helping us come to understand the nature of reality, and also being able to say a few things about what it is to be in right relationship to reality. I mean, the ecological sciences are all about, you know, what we're learning about how to be in right relationship with the reality of this planet, for example, that in a way, science is empirical theology. Scientists could be seen as empirical theologians, and that it even includes scientists that would deny God or deny,
yeah,
you know.
That'd make a bit of difference.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, in my experience, you know, the God that Richard Dawkins says is a delusion is a delusion. That God never existed.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes, yes, yes. Wonderful.
Well,
that's so well put. And that's what, we don't need to go around creating enemies all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If even 10% of what a person is saying is light, why can't I be grateful for that 10% and build
yes.
on it and build bridges toward it and away from it instead of immediately blocking it off?
Yeah, an old mentor of mine told me something that just has stayed with me over the decades, actually. This is probably close to 30 years ago. He gave me what he called the meat and bones principle. He said, Michael, if you expect any person to, like, have it all right, to just be perfect in their thinking or their theology or anything else, he said, you're out of touch with reality, that we all have pieces of the puzzle. We all have
mm-hmm.
facets of the jewel. And he said, apply the meat and bones principle. And here's the meat and bones principle, he said. He said, consider any teaching, any teacher, to be a combination of meat and bones. And what you want to do is be nourished by the meat, but you don't want to choke on the bones. And
mm-hmm.
some teachings and some teachers are, you know, like turkey or chicken. You know, there's a lot of meat and there's not a lot of bone, but you definitely don't want to choke on the bone. And other teachers or other teachings, other books or whatever, are more like spareribs. The meat's really tasty, but, you know, there's a lot of bone there, but you want it to be nourished by the meat and don't choke on the bones. You throw the bones out. And I found that to be one of the most, like, practically useful pieces of advice that I've been able to apply in so many different contexts over the years.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that allowed me to actually, I wrote a sermon and I've delivered it in a number of places, including some of the most conservative parts of the country, thanking God for the new atheists. Even those who are seemingly attacking religion, there's a role that they're playing in this larger body of life that I believe historically will be seen as a positive role. They are helping us to evolve our own religious traditions. And that really comes into the last question that I wanted to ask you, which is, if everything in the universe is evolving, transforming, adapting, changing through time, including our social structures, our institutions, you know, I mean, everything will ultimately either evolve or become irrelevant or go extinct. How do you see the Christian tradition evolving? Like, how do you see it's evolving now? And then if you might venture a guess of how do you see our Christian faith, our Christian tradition evolving into, you know, so let's say the next 100 years or the next 200 years?
Well, I would hope we could, and I think we will, on some level, stop seeing ourselves as a religion in competition with. That merely affirms the ego in our groups and in us as individuals. I think it was Simone Weil, the French mystic. She said, if only Christianity had seen itself as a gift to all religions, as all religions are a gift to us, instead of in competition with the other world religions.
Yeah.
It seems to me we're going to have to cross that line. That, you know, when Mother Teresa died, the Archbishop of Calcutta called me. I couldn't believe I had the Archbishop of Calcutta on the line. And he told me that she had died and he was worried about the community. So he knew my work with community. He invited me to come over there for a few weeks and help him during this immediate period. So happens I was free. I was able to go. But in living inside the community, the sisters told me again and again, they said, Mother told us never try to make Muslims or Hindus into Catholics or Christians. Our job wasn't to talk about Jesus, to convince people of the Christian religion. Our job was to be Jesus and let the cards fall where they may from there. Just be Jesus. That's more than enough agenda for one lifetime to try as best you can, according to your gift, to be Jesus in this context. If Christianity could just be Jesus instead of making Jesus into a product or into an opponent or and always one who builds boundaries instead of bridges, that would be my hope. And that will certainly evolve consciousness and evolve religion and evolve us as individuals, because now I can't build on my ego need to be superior or to be separate. I have to move with the soul, which sees the similarity, which sees the communality in things. It seems to me that could be a much more gracious world.
Amen. Well, Richard, thank you so much for sharing your experience, your perspectives, your heart with our listeners today here on the Leading Edge of Faith.